the musicians are made to feel like they are working for the conductor.
Yeah.
But working with Quincy that day was when it all changed for me. And even though he's like one of the greatest musicians of all time, he got up there. He's like, okay, all right. And he just danced with us. He made us feel like we're all equals.
It was awesome.
He valued how we felt. That is virtuosity and mastery and the mark of an incredible human being.
Go.
Hey, everybody. As you know, this week we lost a giant, one of the most important people in music history, Mr. Quincy Jones. It's been a sad week for everybody as Quincy has impacted so many lives, whether you got to be lucky enough to know him personally or you were inspired simply by his decades of music and his impact in culture, all the boundaries that he broke. It's really incredible. If you haven't seen the Quincy documentary, I highly recommend it. It's an incredible watch, and it really puts into perspective how important he was as a human and what he did even just outside of music, let alone the huge accomplishments in music. So yeah, Quincy is definitely one of the biggest legends of all time, and I'm lucky enough to say that I had Quincy as a friend, as an advisor, and as an investor in Jamcard. In 2018, we started getting our initial success with Jamcard, which led to Quincy following us on Instagram and Adam Fell. Big shout out to Adam Fell, who is Quincy's manager, getting on the Jamcard app, and which led to us meeting with Quincy, and he ended up supporting us and investing in Jamcard, which completely changed my life. Like, as you can imagine, having Quincy endorse what you're doing in music is it makes people pay attention, right? Like, people are like, okay, he doesn't do that a lot, so if Quincy's getting behind something, he must really back it, and his endorsement is like one of the biggest you can get. And even bigger than that, his endorsement made me have the confidence that it takes in order to go on and push through the whole startup world and building a company and building a community. And you got to believe in yourself. That's the most important thing. And him believing in me made me believe in myself in a bigger way than I did before or could really have ever imagined. So I have endless gratitude to Quincy Jones and Quincy Jones Productions and Adam Fell and everyone on that team that really made a huge impact in Jamcard. So thank you, thank you, thank you. And Quincy, we love you so much. Man, like, we will forever remember you and love you. And then, of course, one thing I always wanted to do, and we were able to do it, was I told Quincy I really wanted to do a jam around him. And October 30th, 2019, we were able to do it, and we did the Quincy Jones jam, which is definitely one of the greatest nights of my life. We got a lot of the original Thriller band back together, including Greg Fillinganes, and also had Harvey Mason Sr. on drums, and then we had Jacob Collier and Alfredo Rodriguez and Shalea and so many people from Quincy's life and career there in the building singing, performing, and it was just one of the greatest nights of my life. So, oh, and one thing that I wanted to talk about is Quincy that night. And if you came to that event that night, you know this, because the event ended at 11 o'clock and Quincy sat there and met every single person that wanted to meet him. I ended up leaving at 1 a.m. and he was still there because he hadn't met everyone yet. And I was like, you good? And he was like, yeah, I'm good. He had a security with him. He stayed there until 3 a.m. and talked to every single person that wanted to talk to him. And I will never forget that, because it was like he could tell that he knew that he was going to make an impact in your life just by meeting you and talking with you. And you could also tell that he genuinely loved people and he just wanted to talk to people and he wanted to have a good time. He was clearly an extrovert. But he sat there and talked to every single hundreds of people that were at that event. All, of course, all wanted to meet Quincy and talk to him or give their love to him and show respect and everything. And he did it to everyone. And I'll never forget that, because, you know, at that time, he must have been probably 86. He could have just gone home immediately. He could have gone home before the event ended, which a lot of modern day artists would even do. They'd finish what they were doing. All right, cool. Peace. Out the back door. He stayed there and left after I left. He was the last person to leave the building. And I thought that spoke so much of his character and his impact and just showed how much he cared. I woke up that morning and saw a bunch of texts from friends. And I just saw, I'm sorry about Quincy. And I knew immediately, I was like, oh no, this is it. And then I came downstairs, made coffee, had a glass of water and was like, okay, let's open these texts. And I started reading them. And then I came into my office. And as soon as I came into my office to start my work day, I noticed that, of course, I have Quincy right here looking at me. And that's the artwork from the Quincy Jones Jam Jam that's off camera during the pod typically, but that's always right there. And you'll hear people talk about it in the pod, like, oh man, there's Quincy. And there's another one of him on the wall here. And I also have this framed tweet, which is from when it was announced that Quincy invested in our round, Billboard and Rolling Stone, and everyone tweeted. And so this is a framed tweet saying Quincy Jones joins $1 million funding round for Musicians Network Jam Card. And that was like a major life-changing experience for me. It's the only tweet I have framed, right? So anyways, just wanted to come on here, take the week to honor Quincy, and share some stories, from people who had the privilege of getting to work with him and know him and love him. So, a lot of those people have been on our podcast. So here's a compilation of a lot of Quincy's friends telling stories of working with Quincy. So sending so much love to the Quincy Jones family, and Adam Fell and the whole Quincy Jones Productions team, which is now called Early Hour. Just much love to that whole community. And thank you so much for everything that you have done for me and for us. We appreciate it. And Quincy's impact is going to live on forever. Like, it's not that he's gone now. And so now he's gone, like, watch, like, Quincy will be blessing so many of us for so many years, and he will continue to inspire for generations and generations and generations. So much love to the greatest to ever do it, Quincy Jones. And we hope that these stories bring smiles on your faces as you just hear a bunch of stories of Quincy being awesome. So much love and let's go.
John J.R. Robinson, episode 48.
Quincy and I had a discussion about, you're going to be playing on these songs. I want you to, I go, why don't I just program things I think should be on these records, and we'll bring them in on multi-track, and then Bruce will transfer them and you're going to use them or not. So one thing that did stick was, the intro to, The Way You Make Me Feel. So if you listen to that, and it's really short machine SP-12s.
Wow.
And doosh, 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 ba-boom, 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 ba-boom. So then I came in and overdubbed. We laid all the whatever parts I brought in, and then I laid down real drums. Those days it was Yamaha and Zildjian, and laid down just
over the top of it.
Over the whole top of it.
Wow.
And I had to play it perfectly.
And so you had done the programming on your own and then brought it to Quincy?
Correct.
And do you remember what Quincy's reaction was to hearing it?
I think he was really glad that he had all these guys in these driver's seats.
Yeah.
I mean, he had Larry Williams camped out in one studio programming and helping with Jerry with horns. He had Jerry in this studio. He had Greg in this studio doing shit. It was pretty impressive.
The dream team.
It was the dream team. The whole kit. You're setting it up.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to be the whole kit.
Right.
How about just a kick, snare, and a hat and a ride?
Yes.
And sometimes get rid of the ride cymbal.
Yes.
That's what Quincy used to do to me.
Mm.
He would f*** with me so hard without asking me permission.
He would just, what, like take away a ride cymbal?
No, he'd take away the whole damn kit. Like when we were cutting the Dude, David Williams had split and gone with Jackson's, then Madonna. So we needed a guitar player. So Lukather got the gig. So Lukather was our guitar player. And, you know, between Abe Sr. playing bass and Greg. And
Greg filling gates.
And it was a Monday, and they set me up, and I'm all, you know, what the gobos are around.
Yeah.
And I got to, you know, four toms, and it's, oh yeah, man, sounds great. Swedeen's on fire. We're done. It's 6:30. Bye. See you guys tomorrow at 11. Okay, cool. Come back next day, and Lukather is there early, which I'm totally shocked. And he's laughing. He's, ha, JR, look what they did to your drums. I go, what are you talking about? Like, what do you mean? You know, like a little boy. And I walk and look over, and they're all gone, except for a kick, a snare, a hi-hat. And that was it. And I'm thinking, what the f-? And I walk in. Bruce Swedeen, big Bruce, comes out. He goes, hey. I didn't even say anything. He goes, Quincy doesn't want any fills on this record. And turned around and walked away. And I'm going, yes, sir. Hence, what, 4 Grammys or 5 Grammys?
Wow.
So lesson learned is that inspiration, sometimes you can get it from playing on your legs.
Yeah.
And coming up with some sort of a thing. Sometimes, I'll play on tops of bottles to get a weird sound. When I was just in Asia, I walked in. I think I was in Indonesia, and they have like one of those hand warmer, hand drying machines.
Yeah.
And I put my hand in with, wow, bingo. And I go, okay, this is so stupid. It's so funky.
Right.
So it was inspiration.
That's amazing.
So use anything around the house.
Yeah, because you'll play different when you show up and Quincy's got rid of your toms and your cymbals beside your hi-hat. You'll play different when he plays you the record.
It worked out well.
Wow.
It worked out well. But I was, towards the later years of us recording with Quincy, I managed to sneak some more drums back in.
Yeah, he started trusting you again. Oh, so the kick snare had lasted for a few albums or something?
Yeah.
Wow, I don't, of all albums to not have any fills.
Well, I mean, I know Corita, I talked him into doing a shitload of overdubs.
Nice. You're like, I sent him back up, please.
Yeah.
God, that must have been an incredible album to work on, the dude. Wow.
With
that band?
It was heaven.
Yeah, what is it? I mean, how do you feel like to go back to those days, right? And you look around and it's like you and there's Steve Lukather's on guitar and Phil Gaines is on keys and Abe Senior's on bass.
Jerry's in the room and Larry Williams. All these cats are there.
And Quincy's in the control room and
God,
do you feel like the USA Olympics like basketball team?
It was the dream team.
It's the dream team.
It was a dream team.
Yeah.
And
did you realize it at the time?
That's a tough question. I think not, because if you start getting, I don't think that there was. I mean, I'm sure that Jerry and Rod realized it, but we all conversed at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think that changed the face of the music industry, was that conversion.
Yeah.
And if one were to start thinking about the momentum that you're exhibiting every day in the session, it becomes egotistical.
Yeah, for sure.
And we were not that way.
Yeah. It's crazy because all of you have gone on to make such massive impacts in music.
Yeah.
Both together and individually.
I mean, with Rod, God bless Rod. I ended up, Rod would be funny because he'd come in every day because I knew him from 78 with Heatwave used to open up for Rufus.
Wow.
And actually in 77 they did. And he'd look at me and I was, you know, I had this blonde hair and blue eyes. He just, you know, he's Rod, you know, and he looked at me, he goes, geez, like, he's looking at me like, oh, and you know, you look like that. And I'm thinking, what the fuck are you talking about? And but I would get all these records. I would get Herbie Hancock records and friggin' Carpenters and Karen Carpenter and it just kept going. There were so many damn records, right? Yamo be there, and it just kept going. And it was good. We had a good team.
What was one of your favorite projects you worked on with Rod?
Well, Rock With You, of course. Was the greatest.
John J.R. Robinson, episode 12.
The Rock With You intro.
Right.
Most iconic drum intro, drum fill ever in such a small amount of time. How did you write that fill?
Oh, my God. So, we were cutting for the Off the Wall album, the song Rock With You. But I was very fortunate to be the mainstay drummer through the entire record. So Quincy would cast different rhythm section guys and put them around me. So I was very fortunate to play on every song.
Amazing.
And got to play with different bass players, you know, like Lewis Johnson, and Greg Finnegan's playing synth bass on Don't Stop. But it started by, after I cut a couple of songs, and then they asked me to come back and do the rest of the record on Monday. And that basically was Party Weekend Central before that. got to the studio, boom, boom, boom. We did Don't Stop. And then I get asked, okay, so what's your schedule like coming up? And we want to get your band in and record this song. And I knew, Quincy knew, that it was a hit record written by Rod Temperton. And the song happened to be called Rock With You. And we did not know it at the time. So we were all cast. It was Hawk Walensky on keys, Bobby Watson on bass, and David Williams on guitar. And we were in Westlake B, which ironically is where I cut Gaga.
Wow.
They wanted the exact same vibe, but X amount of decades later. But so we go in, we start listening to Rod's demo, and Rod's very precise and simplistic and has everybody playing a specific part. Now, the drum part, no, there was no drum part. It was just motion. But like the bass part Bobby's playing, it was pretty much verbatim. However, Bobby took liberties and played the most melodic bass part of all. Not until the correct take.
Mm.
So take one, I don't know. I probably I cut it with a click that I programmed. And back then it was a Yuri old film click, 7-frame film click.
Wow.
And so I got the tempo, blah, blah, blah. We start rehearsing and then we're ready to cut. So take one. No magic. You know, okay. Well, let's do it again. Okay. Little Phil, whatever. Take two. Maybe a little better. People are learning their parts. Time's going on. I'm looking in the control room, and I can see Quincy and Rod in there. Rod's puffing on his red Marlboros. And take three. A lot better. No magic. And we're sitting there, kind of in the studio, in a small room. And I see Quincy get up and Rod get up and come out of the door, and Quincy stands right by me, and I'm going, oh, shit. And Rod's standing right here smoking his Marlboros with his English accent. And Quincy goes, JR, he goes, if you could come up with a fill, an intro fill that the whole world would forever identify with this song, could you do that? And maybe on this next take. And I looked at him and I go, sure. like John Belushi, like, and all the guys are like going like this to me, like going, oh,
like, no pressure.
No pressure. What are you going to do? And little did they know that they are going to be put in the exact same amount of pressure because of what's going through my brain. But I didn't know what I was going to do. So I immediately reflected back to the Rod demo, which was, it was weird. And then I thought, what do I hate most about drum fills? I hate when let's just take two examples. One is straight 16th notes and triplets, or putting them together is just wrong.
Yeah.
It's wrong. And so I go, that's what I'm going to do. But I did it more in a syncopated march world. So take four, let's go. And all of a sudden I hear four clicks and then I have to go. So the four clicks were click, 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 click. And I just did that, but I used my military training, my march training, and I added syncopation, and I made sure there was a hole that you could drive an 18-wheeler through to get to the next downbeat. But it all came spontaneously.
In that one take.
And I was like, thank you, God. In that one take. And then we never did another take.
No way.
That was it.
That fill set the magic for the whole take.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, everybody's playing differently. Bobby's bass line is completely different than the other three takes.
Because you hit that downbeat and everyone's like, ooh.
That's what it was. And Quincy knew. They were up dancing and shit, and it was like rot in a rot. It was great. It was great. You know, and blah, 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 blah. So that was And then we kind of knew we had cut a number one record. Oh. It's like all of us looked at each other. We go, we did it.
Wow. That's so much pressure. And you did it in one take. It just came out of you.
And there was no pressure the minute that, I guess the minute the fill happened, but it was really the downbeat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, as a drummer, man, when you land on that downbeat, I mean, there is, that's word.
Yeah. I love that that's one take and it wasn't this like perfectly written or articulated thing, or it wasn't Quincy walking in being like, can you do something kind of like stupid?
No,
like,
no. I mean, in other like, sessions, Quincy's come in with a little piece of music and he's written out some fills for me for other stuff. And I'm, you know, and his penmanship was just perfect.
Yeah.
You know, it's the real deal.
For sure.
And I go, you really want me to play that? And he goes, yeah, play that. You know, anyway, but not on this one.
Oh my God. So you knew you had a hit.
100%.
And is there vocal on that? Is there a demo vocal? Is there a Michael demo vocal when you're cutting those songs?
I don't believe there was a vocal on that. That's just a great question.
Just an instrumental.
But I know he had been working on it way before I even got on the scene.
Right.
Through Rod. But it's Rod is always, he was very precise.
Yeah.
About all his records. Everybody had a, it was like a team, you know. So
on that Bad album, is Michael, yeah, is he there with Quincy and Rod and you, or is it like in and out?
Yes.
Sometimes it's, yeah, like what was it like?
First of all, there's multiple versions of Mike.
I can imagine.
You know, the beginning Mike, which was Rock With You Days.
Yeah.
A real pretty man.
Yeah.
Shy, you know, and then, you know, we get through, you know, the Thriller days, and then you get to We Are The World days, and then you get to Bad. Things started transforming. But Quincy was allowing him to write more. If you ever notice, there's not Michael Jackson songs on the record off the wall.
Mm.
There's co-written.
Mm.
So he started to write more, like Bad. Mm-hmm. Quincy was allowing him to grow up.
Yeah.
And but Mike was there. And it was during the heyday of when we were all doing our jobs. All the studios at Westlake were filled with somebody. So thank God I had D, the big room for the drums, and a big old ass rack of bullshit that I would trigger with a Mac sitting on it. Like, hold on, let me program that. And there's really nothing there.
Yeah.
You know, but Quincy wanted electronics, but Mike was there and he would offer suggestions finally.
Yeah.
You know, which, you know, down to the end days of Michael, he would produce from his car.
Oh my God.
He would like call me and goes, oh, JR, don't forget to put a fill going into the bridge. I really want a specific fill and I'll call back after you do it. I go, okay, why don't you just come into the studio? Tell me what to do.
Yeah.
No, I know you know what to do.
Daru Jones, episode 36.
It's Leo Gang every day. We know there are
other signs. You know, it's funny. You went like this for Leo Gang. So I have a photo. I have a photo of Quincy Jones and I. I was with Quincy. And Quincy always comments on me being a Leo, right? He's always like, that's why you're the leader, man, because you're a Leo. Leos are the leaders. And Quincy always says that to me. I don't know if you ever met Quincy, but one of his first questions is always like, what's your sign?
Wow.
Quincy's super into Zodiac.
Okay.
He's super into Zodiac. So anyways, I have this one photo of him where we went, a photographer went to take a photo of us, and Quincy was like, let's give him the L, right? Like, that's a horrible Quincy impression. It does not sound like him at all, but he was like, let's give him the L, man. So Quincy and I are both like this. We're like, it looks like we're both just giving the loser sign.
Awesome.
Like, we're both looking at the camera, dang. Just like, I remember when we took the photo, I was like, maybe we shouldn't do the L.
Oh, man.
Maybe we do a W for winners.
Wu-Tang
or something.
Wu-Tang for the kids.
Yeah. Big shouts to Quincy Jones.
Yeah, salute. I met him one time overseas during the jazz festival they had. I was playing, doing a set with Logic, DJ Logic. Shout out to Logic. And he was there. Miss Hill was there.
Amazing.
And it was like, man, that's the guy right there. We might be related. The Jones, you know. But
come on, yeah.
maybe down.
Yeah.
But yeah, shout out to
you.
Quincy.
Could be one of his kids.
Thanks. Dang.
Quincy's got a lot of kids.
Man. But yeah, big shout out to Quincy. And when I saw that he was a catalyst for joining you, I was like, that's the stamp.
Man.
Stamps.
That was a game changer.
Stamps, bro.
Yeah, Quincy's the man.
How did you feel about that? Like,
dude, about Quincy Jones investing in Jamcar? Yeah, my God, bro. Yeah. What was crazy was I remember the first thing that happened that tripped me out before Quincy invested in Jamcard. Mm-hmm. He followed us on Instagram. All of a sudden, Christian, do you remember that? We were working and all of a sudden I got the notification on my phone. I don't know. I just opened up Instagram and it was like, Quincy Jones followed Jamcard. Wow. And I was like, what? What? And I remember I ran through the house. We have a video. I think someone took a video of me, like, maybe you did.
Wow.
But I'm laying on the floor. I'm like, Quincy Jones just followed us.
Wow.
On Instagram. And so that was even crazy. Just him, just knowing, be like, man, he's hip to our shit. Wow. Like, this was like, and this was 2017. Mm. Like, this was like the year Jamcar came out, you know, like, and then 2018, we raised our first like $1 million round. And Quincy invested and joined our advisory board.
Wow.
And I remember, to me, man, I mean, that was a trip. The whole thing was a trip, the whole process, like meeting Quincy, getting his support. Quincy has an amazing team. Big shouts to Adam Fell and Tomas and like the whole Quincy Jones production team. Mm. Who managed Jacob Collier and everything. They like run the operations, you know,
Yes, sir.
So big shouts to those guys. And we're close friends. Now we've been friends for years and everything. But yeah, Quincy's support was just, it was so mind blowing. And then I remember the craziest thing, I think what hit me the hardest was when Quincy invested. So, you know, he like, you know, wired me money, right? So that's like, that's cool.
Dang.
I'll take Quincy's money. But the thing that was cooler.
Sin space.
Was. When he signed the contract, the investment agreement, all of a sudden I looked at it and I was like, I have Quincy Jones's autograph.
Yeah, that's crazy. Major hair crackings. That's
but this
crazy.
Is an autograph that's tied to dollars and his belief and support in me as an entrepreneur, which was just like a game changer. Because, you know, what's cool about that is I think on this entrepreneurial journey, mm-hmm. so much of it is you believing in yourself.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Right?
Yes, sir.
Like,
yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And, you know, especially in the early days, whenever you're starting something new, whether mm-hmm. you're starting as a drummer mm-hmm. or you're touring for the first time or you're used to hip hop and now you're in rock or you're starting a company, mm-hmm. you're starting. For me, I had like a career in drums and now I'm starting a tech company. I was fish out of water, man. Hey. I had no friends in tech. So I was like super uncomfortable at first. What do I do here? Right. Mm-hmm. So the biggest thing that Quincy did to me was him believing in me and investing in Jamcard just made me believe in myself.
It's amazing.
That's even impressive. More.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And then that goes so far. Like, believing in yourself is the most important thing. And it's
stepping out on faith.
Stepping out on faith, absolutely. Which I had to do to start Jamcard because I was, you know, making my living as a drummer. I was making a good living. Like,
I was still killing.
I had, you know, thank you. I had luckily plenty of work. You know, I was like, man, I'm good. Like, I could just keep doing this, but I really wanted to start Jamcard and I had to step out on a limb and risk it all to start this thing. I had no idea how to do. Mm-hmm. And that was a whole rough journey. And now it's great, but it was crazy.
I can only imagine, but you stuck it through, you know, and it's a part of your story, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. And when you do the recaps, you know what I'm saying? Like the 5-year or 10-year recaps, you'll be like, man.
Oh, man.
You'll be glad that you at least tried.
Yeah.
Ibrahim Maalouf, episode 3.
Would love to talk about our mutual goat, Quincy Jones. Just getting the recognition from him is obviously such a huge thing. But especially for you being a trumpeter, with him being a trumpeter. So tell me what it was like for you to meet Quincy and to like get acknowledged from him and then for him to become your manager and for you to be with Quincy Jones Productions.
First thing is that, you know, when you live in Los Angeles and you know that Quincy Jones lives in Los Angeles, it's something huge for you to meet him, of course. But when you live in France and you actually were born in Lebanon and for you he's a god, it's something that you can't ever imagine one day meeting someone like him.
Yeah.
Because it feels so far, so different, you know, it's like another world. So I was playing in Montreux Jazz Festival and I knew that Quincy Jones used to come every year to the Montreux Festival, but I knew he was there for the big artists and for the, you know, for Pharrell or for, you know, or for like a huge artist,
yeah,
and
yeah,
for Herbie, and you know, but I wasn't expecting him to come and listen to my show. And I met Thomas and Quincy Jones' production team in Montreux, and they told me, you know, Quincy is gonna listen to your show. He's gonna be on the side of the stage, and they told me also, don't be sad or anything if you see him leaving the show during the concert. But this is what he does in general. He doesn't stay. And I asked, I remember I said, but what, how can I know if he liked the show or not? And I don't remember who answered me. Someone told me, well, you know, sometimes when he likes the show, he orders food. Mm. So, okay, I kept that in mind. And I was like, I mean, if he leaves, he leaves. That's life. But at least I can say Quincy Jones heard me.
Watched you play.
He watched me play and he heard my trumpet. So I was playing on the big stage. And like every 15 seconds, I was like, just, how do you say it? Like looking quickly. You say sneaking or something?
Yeah, you were glancing.
Glancing, yeah.
You're kind of distracted.
Just looking at him, see if he's enjoying or not. Yeah. And then, you know, at some point we were like at half of the concert, I was expecting him to leave at some point, you know. Yeah. And I was always like glancing, looking and da, 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 da. And at some point, I saw a huge plate of sushi arriving towards him.
Yeah.
And while I was playing in my mind, I was like, yes, yes,
that's
yes,
it.
Yes, yes.
You got the tip.
He's staying. You know? So at the end of the show, I went directly towards him and I said, I'm so honored that you're here and that you listened to this show, and I hope you liked it. And he was like, oh man, I loved it, man. I love what you do. And you know, Quincy.
Yep.
So I kept talking.
He's like, you're a Scorpio.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. This is one of the first questions he asked me. and he said, yeah, I'm Libra. Yeah. You're a Scorpio. Oh, nice. and I talked to him like maybe half an hour, 45 minutes or something like this. And he said,
that's awesome.
Yeah. And he suggested me to keep this connection with the Quincy Jones production and work with them.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was crazy. That was one of
and them. Then it just happened. Like that was it.
And then I started to talk more and more with Thomas. Yeah. Thomas Duport.
Our guy.
Yeah.
The one actually, and only.
Yeah, he's actually originally from France, and so it was easy to communicate. You know, the connection, speaking in French, and he explained to me how Quincy Jones works and how the Quincy Jones production works, and so we got along very quickly and easily, and he's such a nice person, as you know.
Yes.
So it's very easy to be a friend with Thomas.
Oh yes.
So we kept this connection and we've been talking for years, and slow by slow, you know, after COVID and after all this, it started to be more and more serious, and yeah, and we kept this connection and we kept working together, and I know that Quincy follows all this and knows what we're doing, and
that's so cool. I'm sure that felt amazing even before the sushi platter and everything, just like when you're starting the show and you look over and like, oh man, he showed up.
Man, I sent messages to everybody I knew. Like not only family and friends, like everybody.
Anyone you ever met.
Do you know what? Quincy Jones is actually right now on stage. I'm going to play now and he's going to listen to me, okay? It's just for info. Just take it.
You don't even have to write back.
You don't have to write back. Yeah, and my, you know, family and everyone was so proud and all this. And when I told them, well, actually, it got even further. We might work together. And he was like, wow, that's crazy.
I'm really grateful for Quincy and for the team and for Thomas and everything, because it's Quincy has introduced me to so many amazing people like you and Jacob and Dirty Loops and all these incredible artists that I'm like now friends with and get to work with and collaborate with just like through him and through the team. And so, yeah, it's been such a blessing. It's a cool group.
He's a soul that helped people loving each other.
Yes,
definitely. From everything he did, from the big Count Basie, Ray Charles, everything, even the for TV, for movies, for everything he did has always been connecting people all the time. And even look,
yeah, he still
and yeah, everything he's doing, and even supporting Gemcard, even everything he does, everything he invests in is about connecting people. He's a huge example for me.
God bless Quincy Jones.
Yeah.
God save the Quincy.
Michael Bearden, episode 39.
I'd like to now kind of move into the, there's a through line here, and there's a big piece of the story that is the South Side of Chicago.
South Side?
You're from the South Side of Chicago. Quincy Jones from the South Side of Chicago. Mm-hmm. Quincy tied to Michael. You did the inauguration. That's for Obama. Michelle Obama from the South Side of Chicago. What's up with the South Side of Chicago? What's up with... look at where you guys all went.
I know, man.
And you've known Michelle forever, right?
We're still good friends to this day. You know, if you look at Quincy's career, it's literally the blueprint of what I do.
Wow.
Only because it's just so important when you're a young kid, like I brought up the Jackson 5, to see people that look like me. Well, to see Quincy, but I didn't even know... the stuff that Quincy did was a thing that you could do. So for instance, you know, my mom really loved Sanford the Son, and we would watch that as kids, and the theme would come on. And so then when the theme came on, you're just like, well, who wrote that? Like, who did that? And then at the end, you see Quincy Jones, you go, oh, that's a thing you could actually do. Wow. Okay. So now I'm like exploring this in my head as a boy, like, well, what does composing mean? Like, what is, then I go back and you see all the films that he did. And then the first original, Bill Cosby show that came out was just Bill Cosby. Hickey Burr is the name of the thing. And, Quincy wrote that. Like, it was all these things. I was like, wow, that's a thing you could do. And then he produces, and then he was music director for, you know, Frank Sinatra with the Basie Band and all, like, all these things. I was just like, wow. And he moved to New York. I moved to New York. He moved to LA. I moved to LA. It's literally the blueprint of what it is that I do.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
So where's your version of the dude, huh? Where's the Michael Bearden? Where's the Bearden solo album?
I love
album?
Talking to Elmo, because this is when people actually understand. If you listen to all those things Quincy and them did, and you know, Quincy had, you know, here we go, Sharp 11s, 13s, you know, flat nines, all type of chord things in it that are not necessarily pop music, but very much what Quincy would do. But Michael singing on top of it, and you still dancing to it. Very complex musical structures and harmony and all of this thing. And it was still simple.
Yeah.
You're still singing, you're still dancing. To me, that was his genius, to make all these complex things feel simple.
God.
That everybody could get to, which is why I'm still getting DMs, my 3-year-old, my 4-year-old, my 5-year-old. Children understand simple things. Mm-hmm. And they're still resonating with him 15 years after his passing. That's simple things. Not complex. He could have absolutely gone, you know, jazzy or whatever way he loved, because he always he loved the what he would call the beautiful notes. He loved like the beautiful harmonies and beautiful complex chordal structures and all that type of thing. And if you listen to him sing these ballads, you can hear that he loved that. He would say to me sometimes, we were talking when we have lunch, he's like, I love the Bee Gees, I love their harmonies, and like all of that type of thing. You can hear all of that.
Yeah.
But he still make it simple.
Yeah.
Still would be simple.
From 8 to 80.
8 to 80 is what he said. 8 to 80. I want to get him from 8 to 80. That was his thing.
Yo, I'm going to take that home. I'm already home.
Jason White, episode 54.
You know, I know you have some guys in here, but I mean, when I saw JR, like, what are those rooms like, bro? Y'all talking about Rock With You, y'all talking about the feels and the Quincy rooms. I'm just like, I would love to be in those rooms like that. And you don't have to be doing anything. You know, some people trying to get on. I want to be in those rooms to, you know, to watch and to see.
You know, it's so funny. You bring up JR and you're saying about being in the room and watching and learning. He talked about this in the interview. He was talking about how when he was done with his parts on when working with Quincy on the MJ stuff, he asked Quincy, because, you know, he was like, all right, you're done. You're like, you can go. And yeah. he asked Quincy, like, can I just stay and watch?
Yeah.
And Quincy said, yeah. And so JR would just sit in the sessions and watch.
Because it's always an opportunity, man.
Man.
So always an opportunity to gleam. And then sometimes I want to see who I'm working for, how they work.
John J.R. Robinson, episode 12.
And I asked Quincy, can I be a fly on the wall and stick around for the whole process? Because I didn't know. I was just 23 or 4 years old. Mm. And he goes, sure. So I'm like sitting back, and then I'm watching Michael sing, and all of a sudden you hear his feet coming through the mic. And so Bruce Swedeen, just the genius engineer, goes, well, I have to fix this somehow. So he built some sort of platform that Michael could still dance while he sang, but you didn't hear it. And so I would sit like a fly on the wall and listen. I'm a Berkeley guy, by the way. Man, I'm smart. I'm a piano player. I know all this harmony. So I'm listening to Michael layer his parts. And I go, that's really cool. And then this note's really cool. And then third note, no, this note's a half step off, man. And I'm hearing it wrong. And then all of a sudden, Mike takes a break and puts the fourth note on. I go, oh, I'm an idiot. I was wrong. And I was like listening to him layer and just the whole concept of you know, us drummers, when we basically lay down, we're building the house from the bottom up.
Yeah.
With hammers and nails and stucco and, you know, whatever, blocks and mud. And then we get to a point and we leave. But we don't ever stay around for the whole record process.
Right, right.
So I learned a lot that, you know.
First one in, first one out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, not
sometimes.
Not Nile Rodgers used to fuck with me and say, yeah, you know, the New York against LA vibe.
Yep.
He'd go, yeah, JR just leaves his car running. I go, well, that's not true.
Be like, I mean, I wrote the Rock With You riff in one take.
Yeah.
And I said, why don't you want me to leave? What am I doing here? You want me to order lunch?
Yeah.
You want me to hang around?
No.
What is a Quincy Jones, Michael Jackson demo like when they call you in, or are you just writing on the spot? There's some programming maybe or some keys.
Well, in the early days, demos were on cassette.
Yeah.
And I'm going to speak about this in my book, because I saw a lot of good and bad come from people's demos.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, in the off-the-wall days, and I got to go back here in my brain, what was, like, I mean, the very first two songs I did was Girlfriend by Paul McCartney. And the second song was It's the Falling in Love by Carol Bayer Sager and David Foster, whom I didn't know who they were.
Yeah.
And the Girlfriend song was really poppy. Girlfriend. It's like, and I'm just like, you know, just kind of playing easy, but I'm grooving. And I think that demo was already on 2-inch.
Really?
In other words, they go, we don't want you to hear the drums.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I go, I don't want to hear the drums.
Yeah.
Just give me the song. I charted the song out and played it.
Yeah.
And that was the same with the second song. And then once we got into the next Monday and did Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, all I remember is Greg Finnegan sitting at a Rhodes and a Mini Moog and me. And I don't remember anybody else. And the room was filled with people. That's how focused it was. And I think that was, there was no demo. It was, I think, already existing. I believe, yeah, it had to have been existing with the Yuri 7-frame click.
Wait, those were the first three sessions you did with Quincy? He brought you in on Paul McCartney first? Holy crap.
Yeah. Well, listen, that was...
And then David Foster, who you ended up working with for years, and then...
Don't forget, back up before that, Quincy produced Rufus and Chaka Khan,
right.
Which was...
Monster Jam.
Master Jam.
Master Jam, excuse me.
Monster Jam actually is good.
Yeah.
With Do You Love What You Feel,
and
I actually had a song on that record. But so he kind of was comfortable with what was going on.
He knew you already. He was like, he's had this guy.
Well, he goes, hey, man, you went to Berkeley too, man. You know, I went to Berkeley, and it was called Schillinger House. I went to Berkeley, and it was Berkeley.
Wow.
You know, but blah.
So he did that with you, and that was how you met him.
I met him Rufus before that, actually. I met him in 78 at a concert in Los Angeles.
Mm.
It was called the Klaus Ogerman called the Orchestra.
Mm.
And it was like all these LA finest players playing at Dorothy Chandler, and I was invited by management, and I sat right by him.
Wow.
And it was kind of orchestrated.
So, but your first time working with him, the opportunity came from Rufus and Shaka.
Yeah.
Which then made him be like, hey, come do this with me. And it's Paul McCartney.
Paul McCartney.
Holy crap. And then it's David Foster, who you end up working with for...
And until, then Carol Bear Sager, who was married to Burt Bacharach, which got me with Burt.
And then it's Don't Stop Till You Get Enough.
Yeah.
Holy
shit. And Greg and I are looking at each other after we got through it. And we looked and we go, we just cut a number one record.
Yeah.
We knew. And everybody's like yelling, like, you know, the Lakers just won.
What was the best lesson Quincy Jones ever taught you?
Oh, God. Well, this was, you know, I became his drummer in 79. And I did everything, even though he would branch out and do some, you know, older legend cats and some big band stuff without me. He always used to say to me, I'm going to make you a star. JR, I'm going to make you a star. He just, because I look where I go, I didn't even know what that meant. You know, and then once I moved to Hollywood, it's like, oh, there's some other shit going on here. I wasn't really concerned with that. Like, yeah. Like maybe acting and doing other stuff and stuff. But we started touring in 81, and we toured Japan. And we played Budokan. You know, it was Patty Austin, James Ingram, Louis Johnson, Greg Fillinganes, Toots Thielemann, Jerry Hay, Rod Temperton. We're playing the Superdome in New Orleans. I come out on stage and I'm checking the people out, and it's, you know, it's almost filled up. And Quincy goes, JR, come here, man. And he goes, see those people way up there? And I thought he was going to say that they knew me and, you know, they wanted to talk to me or something. He goes, they don't give a f- what you play on your hi-hat. And he turned around and walked off the stage. And I'm going, whoa, I just got Quincy'd.
Yeah.
And he, in other words, he did not want me playing all this fancy shit.
Right.
Like certain drummers we have seen are playing all this hi-hat activity.
Yeah.
Where in reality, all you really want is kick and snare drum.
Yeah.
To get through the song. And so, lesson learned.
Wow.
And, you know, and he just ghosted me, just walked right off. Okay. I got it.
Did it
hurt? No, it didn't. I was like, but maybe I wanted to see somebody up there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he kept calling you.
Yes, he did.
For many, many years.
Yes,
for many of the biggest opportunities. One more way that Quincy Jones blessed us was he agreed to be in our debut documentary film, Trap Jazz. I came to Quincy and told him about this idea that we had for this film. And I really wanted him to hear Trap Jazz and see these guys, Devin Sticks Taylor, Chris Moten, and Cassius J. Told him about this Trap Jazz sound that they were making. So we ended up bringing those guys, put an incredible ensemble together, and they wrote this amazing arrangement of Quincy Jones songs and performed it for him at the Jam Jam. And you may have seen clips from that. A few clips went viral, especially them playing their trapped out version of Soul Bossa Nova, which is so sick. But Quincy met the guys, talked with them, gave them advice, got to hang with them, watched them play, loved it, and then agreed to be in the film, which really moved the needle for us. So thank you so much, Quincy, and big shouts to QD3, Quincy's son, for all the support and allowing that to happen.
Miguel Atwood Ferguson, episode 49.
What's a performance that you've done that stands out to you?
Well, in 2004, we did a tribute to Henry Mancini at Walt Disney Concert Hall here in LA. And that was not like my favorite concert ever, but it was like one of the most important for me personally. I did perform with Henry Mancini live on TV when I was 12. And so I connected with him some then, and then became a massive fan in being a teenager in my 20s, and I'm still just discovering so many gems from him. But in 2004, there was a tribute, and that was the one time I actually performed with Stevie Wonder and Quincy Jones, and I was just playing in the viola section. But that was absolutely amazing. So Stevie Wonder, I mean, one of my biggest inspirations. And he played Moon River, and he played harmonica with Take Six. Take Six was there singing, and Quincy was conducting. John Williams, the film composer, conducted a couple songs.
Wow.
Plas Johnson, that played the tenor sax on the Pink Panther theme, was there.
And crazy.
Joey DeFrancesco, rest in peace, was on organ. And it was a magical concert. And specifically, I'd say that was the night that let me know that even though I'm not like a well-studied conductor, I can conduct efficiently and do a good job and know how to conduct, because not to dismiss the amazing conductors that I've been lucky enough to work with in the Western European classical realm, and it's improving all the time, but often there's like this authoritarian thing going on where it's almost as if the musicians are made to feel like they are subordinates and they are working for the conductor.
Yeah.
Instead of like working for the music, or, you know, it's, it feels like slavery sometimes. Mm. And, working with Quincy that day was when it all changed for me. And when everything kind of just came together.
Wow.
He might've been a little bit tipsy, but he came up on the concert and he just had the greatest vibe. And even though he's like one of the greatest musicians of all time, he made us feel like we're all equals.
It's awesome.
And that he valued how we felt. It sounds so crazy, right?
Wow.
So to be able to communicate that in such a real way, that is virtuosity and mastery and the mark of an incredible human being.
Wow.
And so he got up there. He's like, okay, all right. And he just danced with us and he gave some cues. So he was, you know, he was helpful, you know, musically speaking too, but it was just a vibe. But it wasn't theatrics. It was to help us and to facilitate the music. And that was when, you know, I even thought like, oh, okay.
Wow.
You know, that's resonating with me.
Yeah.
And I want to do this. And so I don't conduct that many orchestral concerts every year, probably just two or three. But that concert for certain stands out to me.
Jeff Giddy, episode 15.
I remember one day just being depressed and just like doing research. I remember reading bunch of Wikipedia pages, reading Quincy's Wikipedia page. And Quincy, I read about the tour that he had his band, and he couldn't even send his band home early. I think it was in the 50s, in like somewhere in Europe. He couldn't even send his band home because he was so broke.
Yeah.
And he said that's when he learned the difference between music and business. And when I read that quote, I was like, oh my God, this is exactly where I am.
Yeah.
He turned the corner at that point in his life. I could turn the corner now. And so I just said, you know what? Called my friend in LA. I said, yo, do you still have that extra bedroom that you use as storage? He's like, yeah. I'm like, how about I pay you for that rent right now? He's like, you sure you want to live there? I'm like, yep. He's like, all right, when do you want to come? I'm like, next week. And so like, I remember getting there and getting sick and being like, what? And in this room, and the room was so dirty, like, and dusty. And I was in this fucking air mattress on this mattress with no like sheets, and it was so dirty. And I'm like sick. And I'm like, what the fuck did I just do? Like, why am I running around in circles? The very next day, Henri Gill sends me a text. I'm like, dude, I'm in town. If you need anything, he sends me a text. She's like, did you say you're in town? I'm like, yeah. He's like, okay, cool. I got something for you this Sunday, but you got to rehearse tomorrow. Can you do it? I'm like, yep, whatever it is. I didn't know what the fuck it was. Then he sends me a list of a few songs to learn. I'm like, these are all Stevie Wonder songs. What's going on? So I show up to rehearsal and I'm playing guitar with Stevie.
No way.
Yeah.
Just straight up the next day after you were in LA.
So it was literally 2 days later. And that's when I knew, okay, I needed a sign. I needed my faith to be restored. And that was
your sign.
John J.R. Robinson, episode 48.
Man, and now 50 years later, so you got King of the Groove coming out, your book.
Yeah.
And you have the foreword written by Quincy.
Oh. It just gives me chills.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's not like I'm working for Quincy Jones and I'm coming in. It's like I am his brother.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
And family. And yeah. And that's how magical that time frame started, you know, with yeah. Jerry Hayes and the Rod Tepertons and the Patty Austins and the mm-hmm. Michael Boddickers and Greg Fillinganes and Louis Johnsons and Hawk. And it just kept going. And we were all a familia.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad he's still around.
Yeah.
And I will be forever indebted
yeah.
to his grace.
Yeah. Did you like, tell me about, did you like ask him to do the foreword or?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we went through the channels the yeah. correctly. And you know, when I had done my Time Machine DVD with Don Lombardi,
yeah.
which we won DVD of the year, and that was his first DVD Don had ever done.
That's awesome.
We went in and interviewed Quincy. He was funny. He talked about stealing me from Rufus.
Yeah.
And I basically, in a nutshell, said, well, you know, good job.
I fell in love with you the first time I heard you. And that's why I tried to steal you.
Well, mission accomplished.
Always think back to Shock and Rufus.
Oh, jeez.
That Hawk, you know, that was the same year we did Off the Wall.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Never forget it.
You know, when I was a little kid and going to these jazz camps, I went, and there was one up in South Dakota, and I was from Southwest Iowa, kind of north of Kansas City and southwest of Des Moines. And I wanted to go to the Quincy Jones music camp.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it was Rapid City or I don't know where the hell it was. And it was, you know, it's like an 8-hour, 9-hour drive. And my dad said, no, I'm not driving you there. And they're like, how am I going to get there? Well, you're not going. So I was kind of pissed off. And, I told Quincy that I couldn't go to your camp but it always was in my brain. Then all mm-hmm. of a sudden, you know, we got put together.
Maybe you going to the camp would have blocked it from your whole future. That did happen.
I know he would have gone, God, this guy sucks.
He's, oh, the kid from the camp. Oh
yeah. I mean, look at his long blonde hair. What is he doing? No, I'm kidding.
Who does he think he is?
Yeah. Quincy would say, if you play that, don't play that shit. You're dancing too much.
You're dancing too much.
That was it. So I had another lesson learned. But
wait, Quincy would say that for
to me
for metal?
No,
just if you're playing too much.
I just overplaying. Yeah, overplaying.
Wow,
you're dancing too much.
You're dancing,
JR. You're dancing too much. Or I don't give a shit what you're playing in your hi-hat. Nobody gives a shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Less is more. Sometimes when you don't play anything or change it, that's why reggae is kind of hip.
Yeah,
you know where things are 2-4-ish. And there's this other, there's all this whole other movement or Cuban music, which is really not North American drum oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was never written that way. You compartmentalize this joke and put it into this form.
Yeah.
So as a drummer, you know that there's an intro. Well, hopefully, you know, in my days we had intros, hence intros. But,
hence my intros.
Well. thank you. But, I did learn from the masters
yeah.
and, so, you know, that there's going to be, let's, we're talking kind of contemporary forms, even a Herbie Hancock advanced jazz tune, it's still AABA,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, but it depends how, you know, you phrase it in pop music, rock music and R&B music. It's quite staunch.
Yeah.
And I used to think about getting away with something to sneak a style in. So I would theoretically invent that. And then, you know, and Quincy finally says, you know, you're dancing too much again. Yeah. So then you go, all right, now that sucked. You know, so I'm not going to do that. So you just, you know your form. And when it comes, A, if it's being recorded, and you screw up, make it the biggest mistake ever and plow right through it, you know, like an offensive line.
Yeah.
But then when you do it again, you know what you did.
Wow. One other thing that I thought was incredibly cool was Questlove posted a list of 10 takeaways that Quincy would hammer into him every time they bumped into each other. And I thought this list was amazing, so I wanted to share it with you. Number one, the importance of connecting to people, whether scoring, songwriting, or business ventures, and your song, message, or product
has to give goosebumps. It must give goosebumps. Number two, you can't polish doo-doo. The best singer can't save a bad song. The most limited singer often makes hit songs because limited musicians serve the song and virtuosos tend to let their ego show off too much. The song must resonate. Number three, I love this one. Always record your music when your musicians are tired, from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. You'll get the best results because theta brainwaves are subconscious. Always use the non-overthinking hours to let the magic in. Number four, my contact list is my most important instrument. My contact list is my most important instrument. I feel that one. Number five, the importance of sequencing albums and shows. Know how to balance your song material to your more experimental material. Number six, never look down on the generation that's ahead of you. Never neglect the creations of the generation in your rearview mirror. Number seven, study and master all arenas of creativity. Number eight, you are never too old to achieve a new plateau or goal. You are never too old to achieve a new plateau or goal. Number nine, edit, edit, edit. Less is more. Simplify, bring it down. Number 10, pay it forward to the next person. Rest in peace, Quincy Jones. We love you so much.
This is the stuff, man.